Chapter 36. Marin 8. Marin splashed a cupful of water on his face, sighing in pleasure as the cool liquid washed away the sweat and fatigue of a day spent sparring. Around him, the Shieldhome monastery grounds bustled with unusual activity. Kolinar wasn't at war, not yet, but Lord Dalinar's pronounced neutrality and the subsequent sealing of the Oath Gate felt like a bad sign. Citizens and lords alike came to Shieldhome to work out frustrations and perhaps to prepare. Just in case. Marin was beginning to learn that the world of a nobleman was far more morally ambiguous than he had presumed. The ballads spoke of right and wrong, and they always warned their audience which side to believe in. Even when a figure was portrayed as both evil and heroic, such as Jarna the Tyrant, there was always a separation of actions from character. To become a conqueror was bad. However, fighting with honor and bravery, as Jarna always had, was good. Those ideals seemed frail when compared with Alethkar's current situation. Assassination was an evil act, not to mention unheroic. But what if those assassins had been sent to stop a man who was planning tyranny himself? Many whispered that King Elokar, who had turned back from Prala reluctantly, had been planning now to invade Yakaved. The rumors said this was why the king hadn't dismissed his armies, and why he was so quick to react against Jezzan Rosh's offense. Surely planning an invasion of the south, a land held to be one of Alethkar's truest allies, was a dishonorable act. If Jezzan Rosh knew of this and tried to stop it, was he justified in using assassins against his own king? Marin could tell he wasn't the only one worried about this dichotomy. The people wanted an answer. The biggest problem in Kolinar wasn't the fact that their countrymen were at war. The real problem was that Lord Dalinar, the most revered man in all of Alethkar, refused to tell his people which side was right. It left men wondering and whispering. Perhaps Lord Dalinar didn't know what was right either. That possibility scared them more than anything else.
"Don't think so hard, kid," Chadron said. "You're giving me a headache."
Marin smiled at the aging monk. After Marin's battle during the assassination attempt, something had changed between Marin and Vasher's little band of monks. Instead of just regarding Marin as Vasher's apprentice, the eight men had begun to accept him as one of their own. Though Vasher was still Marin's trainer, the others had begun to joke and spar with Marin, and they generally seemed to regard him with the fondness one gave a little brother or junior team member.
"Chadron," Marin asked, "who do you think's right, Jezzan Rosh or the king?"
The elder warrior shrugged.
"I haven't met either one."
"You don't have to meet them to know if they're right or not," Marin prodded.
"Oh, I don't know," Chadron replied with a wide, gap-toothed smile. "Whether or not a fellow's right often depends on how much I like him."
Tatter, a leaner man whose only remaining hairs were completely gray, snorted.
"I guess the wenches are always right then, eh, Chadron? You seem to like them more than you like anyone."
"Wouldn't know anymore," Chadron said, raising a cup to his lips and obscuring his face. "Monks don't do things like visit the wenches. Wouldn't be proper of them."
Tatter snorted his response to that comment.
"No," Marin complained. "What do you really think? About the king's war, I mean."
"Such things aren't meant for discussing by you, little spearman," Vasher said from a short distance away. "And even less meant for us. Lord Dalinar is a wise man. If he says that it isn't for us to choose sides, then we won't choose sides. Personally, I doubt either one of them are right."
"So, was what I did in the palace wrong?"
Marin asked, turning toward his trainer.
"Should I have let the assassins pass?"
"No, boy," Vasher said. "What you did was right. Even if you did go against my command that you refrain from sparring."
"But I didn't spar, I—"
"Oh, he knows," Chadron said with a laugh. "He's just getting on you, kid."
Marin caught a hint of a smile in Vasher's eyes.
"What you did was right," Vasher repeated. "You saved your king's life. It isn't your place to decide if that life was worthy of saving or not, though it is Lord Dalinar's place to decide whether or not his armies will act against Jezenrosh."
Marin nodded.
"Now, how is that shoulder?" Vasher asked.
Marin rolled his arm. "The bruise is almost gone now," he said.
"You're lucky," Vasher said. "He must not have hit you square on. A punch like that from a man in plate should have broken a few bones."
Marin nodded, rubbing his arm. The motion only reminded him of his other wound, however, the one that he hadn't told anyone about. Though he had felt the glyph ward burn in his palm as if it were molten, it had left no mark. His hand had been numb for 3 days following the assassination attempt, but feeling had slowly returned. Now he could feel no remnant of either pain or numbness. No one knew what to make of the torn tapestries and rugs.
Arador had been dazed following the battle and didn't seem to remember the storm that had blown through the hallway. Jezenrosh's shardbearers were dead, and no one else had seen the winds.
And so Marin had remained quiet about the event, pleading confusion as to what had brought so much dust into the hallway. He tried to ignore the hollow sensation he felt now that the glyph ward was gone. Its power had been expended, the magic locked within its stone gone. It was best to move on.
"Hey, Vasher," Chadron said. "The kid's getting pretty good, eh? Bet you didn't expect him to be able to take down a shardbearer in plate like that."
Marin blushed.
"That was mostly Arador," he said. "I was so useless in the fight, it's a wonder I didn't cut off my own leg."
Several of the men laughed at this, but Chadron wasn't finished.
"You should teach him how to skep, Vasher," the burly warrior said. "He's probably ready."
"Hey, that's a good idea,"
one of the other men, Danib, said. Several of the others nodded their approval. Vasher glared at the group of monks.
"He's not ready," he said. "The boy hasn't even bonded his blade yet. He can't skep until then anyway."
"We might not have much more time to train him, Vasher," Tatter said, shaking his head. "Great things are happening outside our little monastic island. How long will it be before some lord decides to drag the boy away to war? The shardbearers he duels on the battlefield won't care if he's ready or not. You should at least train him to defend himself."
Vasher continued to glare.
"He really is ready, Vasher," Danev put in. "You've heard Lord Arador praise the boy's dueling skill. He's twice as good as any of us were at his age, and he hasn't even had that blade 100 days yet."
Vasher grunted, studying Marin. Marin was uncertain what they were talking about, but he was equally certain that whatever it was, he wanted to learn it.
"Yeah, Vasher," he joined in. "At least teach the boy how to defend himself."
Vasher snorted with a slight smile, then nodded toward the other side of the courtyard where a large group of noblemen were sparring in the sand.
"See the shardbearer in blue?"
Vasher asked, pointing out a younger man in bright blue shardplate.
"Put on your plate and go challenge him to a duel."
Marin paused.
"But you told me not to duel."
"Last week you couldn't wait to embarrass yourself. Now you're arguing with me? Get!"
Marin jumped, rushing over to ask one of the younger monks to invite the other shardbearer to duel. Then Marin quickly went to the dressing square, where several other young monks helped him don the shardplate. Marin knew the man he was about to spar. His name was Kalvan, a distant cousin to the Kolin. The man had done moderately well in the dueling competition, finishing near the middle of the pack of contestants. Several groups of onlookers gestured and nudged one another as Marin approached the dueling ring. Some smirked in amusement, others were simply curious. Though the rumors rightly claimed that Arador had really been the one to save the king, Marin had taken part in the battle. If people had been curious about him before, they were doubly so now.
"So what will it mean to them if I lose this duel?"
Marin thought with sudden apprehension, realizing that most of the courtyard had stopped its sparring to gather around his ring.
What will it mean if I win?
Meron raised his blade to indicate that he was ready, and Kalvan stepped forward. The man's stance was different from Meron's. He kept the blade closer to his body, its tip raised higher in the air. Meron struck first. Propelled by the speed of shard plate, he danced across the sand, swinging his blade in the sweeps Basher had taught him. His opponent parried each blow with ease, then delivered a strike directly against Meron's helm. Meron pulled to a stop in the sand, gritting his teeth as the scorekeeper awarded a point to Kalvan.
Focus,
Meron told himself, repeating Basher's oft-voiced counsel.
Feel the form and let it do the work.
Meron approached the second bout more carefully, letting his opponent make the first move. When the man struck, Meron was able to block the first blow and try a counter-strike. His opponent easily turned Meron's blade away, but Meron let the form pull him back just out of reach. Meron was actually surprised when his follow-up attack connected with Kalvan's shoulder. Several members of the crowd nodded appreciatively at this, but the third point made them more skeptical, as Meron didn't last to the count of three before taking a blow to the side. Meron grunted slightly at the impact. Even a dulled blade had a powerful force behind it. Kalvan had 2 points, though he couldn't win until he struck Meron twice in the same place. Meron still had a chance. He advanced, wary and careful, just as he had been trained. He did everything right. He followed the form properly, he let reflex direct his movements, and he swung his blade with precision. Yet the exchange still ended with a second blow to Meron's helm, officially ending the contest. There was a general air of snickering as Meron pulled off his helm, nodding in respect to his opponent. On the battlefield, Meron would have been dead. Here in the monastery courtyard, he was just shamed. He'd barely put up a fight. The crowd dispersed as the monks helped Meron out of his armor. Then he slunk back toward Basher and the others. No matter how crowded the courtyard got, Vasher's corner somehow remained comfortably free of interlopers. Meron took a drink with bowed head and flexed his lightly aching shoulder. Whatever it was the others had been encouraging Basher to teach him, Meron would not learn it this day.
Well? Basher asked.
You saw, Meron said. I didn't do so well.
Why? Basher asked.
Meron shrugged.
I can't tell, he said honestly. I thought I was doing everything right. The form, it just wasn't enough. My attacks were too easy to block and my swings were too wide. They left too many openings. Not enough practice, I guess.
Basher grunted, eyeing him.
Oh, stop sulking. There was no way you were going to win that bout. Kalvan Nadadin is an accomplished and experienced duelist, and you've never fought a bout in plate before.
Then why did you make me fight him? Meron protested.
The fight wasn't the test, kid,
Chadron said, seated in the wall's shade a short distance away.
The question afterward was...
Meron paused.
A question afterward?
The form I'm teaching you isn't really one of the 20 dueling styles, Meron, Basher explained. It's something else. Something we came up with ourselves.
By we, Chadron added, he means I, Basher, developed this all by myself.
Basher shot the man a glare, then turned back to Meron.
The style has its weaknesses, he said. It depends on knowing where your opponent is going to strike before he moves, something you can only do by fighting many men and understanding instinctively how your opponents think. It is a form that allows flexibility and ease of motion, letting you anticipate and adapt. It's a difficult style of fighting, little spearman. You probably won't win many duels until you master it. Once you do, you'll win them all.
Meron frowned.
Then what is this skepping that the others mentioned?
Something you don't need to know at the moment, Basher said.
Then, however, he raised a hand to cut off Meron's objection.
However, it might be a good idea to start training you just in case. Here, sit down.
Marin did so eagerly, settling himself on the sand. Basher seated himself directly in front of Marin, adopting an almost meditative pose.
"Hold out your hand in front of yourself, pointing at me. Then hold up one finger and point it at the sky."
Marin did as commanded.
"What do you see?" Basher asked.
My finger?"
Marin replied.
"Now focus on me," Basher commanded. "Leave your hand where it is. What do you see?"
Marin frowned in confusion. "The same thing."
"The same?" Basher asked. "Or two copies of the same?"
"Well, yes," Marin said. "If I focus on you, I see two versions of my finger, one from each eye."
"Exactly," Basher said. "Now, I want you to focus your attention away from the two fingers. Keep looking at me, but try and see through your fingers. First one, then the other. If you concentrate hard enough, you should be able to see what is beyond, even though your finger is in the way."
"All right," Marin said.
Basher stood.
"When you can make both fingers disappear at once, you'll be ready to learn skepping."
"That's it,"
Marin protested, lowering his finger. Chadron laughed.
"Be glad, kid. At least he didn't make you do anything completely pointless. I remember him once forcing a student to try and snatch raindrops from the sky during a high storm."
Basher grunted.
"This isn't a pointless exercise, Chadron," he snapped. "It will teach the boy to focus and to control his perceptions. It will train his mind for what is to come. If you can come up with a better meditative exercise, then you can go find your own student."
Marin smiled at the repartee, holding his finger up again and trying to make the separate images disappear as Basher had taught. Unfortunately, now that his master had moved, the view in front of Marin was that of the other noblemen. They continued their sparring, their laughter, and their camaraderie, all without even passing a glance by Vasher's corner of the courtyard.
"They still don't accept me," Marin said. "I thought maybe helping Arador save the king would change things, but it didn't. They're polite, some are even respectful, but they don't like me. I don't think I'll ever be one of them."
"Good," Basher said. "I'll leave the boy alone, Basher," Chadron said. "Just because we left that world behind doesn't mean it's bad for everyone." "The boy needs to know the truth," Basher said firmly. "They'll never accept you, Marin. Never. You remind them too much of what they are not, and that makes them uncomfortable. They're jealous of you because of what you've done in saving the king."
"But everyone knows that was Arador," Marin said.
"Doesn't matter," Basher said. "They're jealous. And, more importantly, they're angry that you aren't beneath them anymore. You're even above most of them in rank. They're angry that Lord Dalinar gave you a place in his house, and they're never, never going to accept you as one of their own. Get used to it."
Marin lowered his eyes, staring down at the uncountable grains of sand before him.
"Lord Dalinar said something similar, back when I first got my blade. He said I wouldn't be able to make them like me, but I might be able to make them respect me."
"Lord Dalinar is a wise man," Basher repeated.
"A wise man," Chadron said quietly.
"A liar, but still wise."
Basher shot Chadron a laconic glare, and for the first time Chadron looked as if he regretted one of his quips. Chadron glanced away, blushing slightly. Before Marin could voice a question, Basher turned the stare toward him, forcing him to choke down the inquiry. The topic of Lord Dalinar's supposed lies was not to be discussed. As soon as Marin returned from the monastery, he went looking for Arador. His friend had been notably absent from sparring recently. Part of this was due, of course, to Arador's wound. The cut on his side had been deep, and it nearly cost him the use of his arm. He would not soon swing a sword with that hand again. There was more to it, though. Of all the members of Lord Dalinar's house, inactivity seemed to aggravate Arador the most. Meran saw the look in his friend's eyes the last few times Arador had visited the monastery. The young nobleman didn't seem to find solace or relief in exercise, but rather saw the sparring as a reminder of the war he thought he should be fighting. Indeed, Arador had been uncharacteristically pensive these last few weeks. Meran never knew where to locate his friend anymore. Arador could no longer be found sparring at the monastery, lounging near the ladies' gardens, or drinking with friends in the local taverns. Instead, Dalinar's heir tended to sulk in the quiet palace sitting rooms, where he would sit with dissatisfied eyes and a snappish attitude, or sometimes he would wander the palace, pacing and brooding like a vengeful storm shade. The worst sign of all was Arador's refusal to accompany his father when visiting local noblemen. Lord Dalinar was gone at the moment, in fact, on a 3-day trip. Meran would have thought that Arador would welcome the chance to leave Kolinar, but the heir had complained fatigue from his injury and remained behind. Meran shook his head. Not like Arador at all. Meran strode into the palace. He made a point of visiting his friend every day to try and lift the man's spirits, and so he made his way to Arador's rooms. The steward there, however, informed Meran that Lord Arador was absent, and, like usual, Arador had left no word of his destination. Meran sighed, knocking on the door across the hallway instead. A familiar voice called for him to enter. Renarin employed no steward. Meran opened the door and stepped inside. There was something oddly sanitary about Renarin's quarters. They didn't quite look like someone lived in them. The boy was tidy, almost to a fault, and he shunned ornamentation. Meran, by Arador's recommendation, had commissioned several works of glyph art from local artists and hung them in his room. Renarin's walls were empty, and though his quarters were far larger than Meran's, they held about half as much furniture and no rugs. The room's only sign of personalization was the desk near the corner of the room, a piece of furniture that held several stacks of glyph-covered papers. Meran walked across the empty room, picking up the topmost paper. The glyphs were pressed on its page in haphazard, almost frustrated sequences. Meran recognized most of them. Simple numbers, nothing like the complex characters used in paintings or books of literature.
"I'm on the balcony,"
Renarin's voice called from a short distance away. Meran replaced the paper and made his way out onto the balcony. Though the Kolinar Palace was only one story tall, it had been built on a slight cleft in the land, allowing all of the rooms on the backmost wall to overlook the city. Lord Dalinar's balcony monopolized most of the space, but Renarin's rooms had a small section to the side of his father's. Renarin stood in simple whitish-gray clothing, not even wearing a cloak. He leaned against the balcony's stone railing, staring out, not at the city, but instead up into the sky toward a pattern of clouds that drifted toward the lake. Not dark high-storm clouds, but regular white ones, the kind that Arador claimed were far more common near the coast.
"Have you seen your brother around today?"
Meran asked, walking up to stand beside Renarin. Renarin's shake of the head was almost imperceptibly slight. Meran squinted up into the sky, trying unsuccessfully to delve just what it was about the clouds that fascinated Renarin so.
"He didn't come to sparring again today," Meran said. "The healer said he should try and work his good arm so that he doesn't get too weak, but he hasn't shown up all week."
Renarin nodded. Meran sighed, leaning against the railing.
"It's just a cloud, Renarin. What's so fascinating about it?"
"I don't know," Renarin answered after a pause. "I wish I did."
Meran shook his head. Sometimes talking with Renarin was about as informative as a conversation with a rock. Renarin frowned, still watching the cloud.
"Do you ever think that you might be missing something?"
"Missing something?" Meran asked. "Like what? An appointment?"
"No," Renarin said. "Something bigger. Like a piece of you that isn't there and never has been. But you can feel the space where it should go,
and you wonder if everyone feels that space and doesn't recognize it, or if they all have the peace and you don't.
Marin frowned.
I don't know, Renarin, he said, trying his best to answer the question. I always dreamed about the ballads and the wars. I wanted to be part of something like the stories I had heard. And suddenly I was, and it turned out to be very different from what I had expected. There isn't much glory in watching your friends get cut down by arrows and spears.
But you became a shard-bearer, Renarin noted.
Marin grunted.
And sometimes I wonder if that was a blessing from the Almighty or just some kind of divine prank.
Renarin smiled.
At least you got what you wanted, even if you later realized it wasn't what you had thought. Me? I don't even know what it is I want. I'll probably never be a shard-bearer again, and the king certainly isn't going to appoint me to any important positions.
You'll always have a place in Kolinar, Marin said. Ardor will see to that.
Coddled by my elder brother, Renarin said, shaking his head. There should be more.
He glanced back toward the room. Marin followed his gaze toward the desk with its papers.
Things have been confusing recently, Marin. I write at my equations and my numbers like I did even as a child, but something's wrong. I can't find the answers anymore. It's like I don't have all the numbers. It's like the universe can count to 10, but I can only reach 5.
Renarin, Marin said flatly, I have absolutely no idea what that's supposed to mean. Renarin smiled.
Neither do I suppose. I guess that's the problem.
Marin shook his head, sighing. How could someone be so depressing if you didn't even understand what they were talking about? As Marin turned, he noticed something from the palace grounds below. There was motion at the stables.
Has your father returned early? He asked.
Not that I know of, Renarin said, watching the cloud again. Marin frowned. There was certainly something going on down there.
Come on,
he said, tugging at Renarin's shoulder. It would do the boy good to get out of his rooms.
Lord Arador has decided to ride out and meet his father, the stablemaster explained. We're preparing his mounts.
To meet his father? Marin asked.
But Lord Dalinar is expected back in just a couple of days. Arador will have to turn around and come back almost as soon as he arrives.
I don't question the command of my betters, my lord, the stablemaster huffed.
And neither should you, his tone implied. Marin sighed. The stable hands were preparing at least 2 10 sets of horses. Arador obviously intended to travel well attended. What was he thinking? And why hadn't he mentioned the decision to Marin? Marin glanced at Renarin, who was studying the horses intently. Eventually, Renarin just shrugged.
I guess we can just ask him.
Marin followed Renarin's nod toward where a group of figures was crossing the palace courtyard. Arador, dressed for riding, strode at their head, his deep blue Colin cloak billowing behind him. 15 men accompanied him. Marin did a quick face count and came up with a surprising list.
5 shard-bearers, including Arador, he mumbled to Renarin, and the rest are fairly high-ranking as well. What is his purpose?
Renarin didn't reply. Arador noticed the two of them and paused, then walked forward to meet them. He adopted a friendly smile, reminiscent of the old Arador, but it seemed a bit forced. Still, it was good to see him walking so firmly, his head held high, the brooding gone from his eyes.
Ah, Marin, Arador said. I've been looking for you. I didn't want to leave without letting you know where I'd gone.
Marin frowned, glancing toward the horses. The other men were packing the last of their gear and mounting up.
What is the meaning of this, Arador? Marin asked. It doesn't make any sense. Lord Dalinar will be back within a couple of days anyway.
I've had a change of heart, Arador explained. I can't sit around anymore. I have to go to him. Father needs me right now. He said so himself.
Well, I guess I'll have to go pack, Marin said slowly. Or did you already take care of that?
You aren't coming, Ardor said.
The words were like a slap across the face. Ardor had always included him.
But I'm sorry, Meryn, Ardor said with a shake of his head. I can't take you this time.
Don't worry, it won't be for long. You wouldn't want to come anyway. It will be a boring trip.
I don't understand, Meryn complained. If it's such a minor trip, then why does it matter if I come? Why—
He's not going to meet Father, Renarin interrupted in a quiet yet piercing voice.
Meryn paused, noting the flash of shame in Ardor's eyes.
The pack horses, Meryn realized. There are too many of them. They wouldn't need so many supplies for a 2-day trip.
The war, Meryn said. You're going to fight.
Ardor shot a furtive glance at the working stable hands, then turned back to Meryn and Renarin, speaking in a low voice.
You can't tell anyone, he said. Father will try to find a way to stop us.
Meryn paled.
You're disobeying Lord Dalinar's direct command.
Ardor paused, then nodded once.
I can't remain here in Kolinar, Meryn. I need to find out for myself if my cousin is a traitor, and I don't trust the king. I received a letter from Lady Yasna the night of the dueling competition. She seemed to think that her life was in danger, that the queen herself was involved in the assassination attempt on the king. There's more to this entire mess than people are telling us.
If Lord Dalinar knew something, he'd tell us, Meryn asserted.
Probably, Arador agreed. But Yasna sent the letter to me, not Father. She knows what I know, that Father is too conservative. He's too worried about propriety sometimes, and this waiting proves it. He doesn't know which side is right, so he won't help either one, lest he choose incorrectly and find himself in the wrong. Well, I'm more of a gambler, and so are those who've decided to join me.
There are things on the winds that just don't smell right, Meryn.
Everyone knows the king has been dissatisfied with Jezzan Rosh for some time, and he's been suspiciously slow in disbanding his armies.
There's something very convenient about the way those assassins struck, giving the king a perfect opportunity to move against Crossguard. Well, my companions and I don't intend to let Elokar raise his hand against one of our own until we're certain the move is just.
Meryn opened his mouth, then closed it.
How do I make a decision like this? Choose between Lord Dalinar and Arador?
This could cost you your title, Arador, Renarin whispered.
Ardor smiled wryly.
Father taught me too well. He always told me it was best to do what I knew was right in my heart. Well, this is right, and I'm going. We can work out the consequences later. Besides, what is the worth of a title when you don't use it to seek what is just?
He taught me that, too.
Father will chase you down, Renarin warned. He'll have to send men after you to protect the integrity of his command.
Ardor nodded. Oh, he'll send men. But he won't catch us, no matter how fast his horses ride.
Meryn stood, trapped by his own indecisiveness. How could he let Arador ride without him, the man who had befriended him, and who had taught him what it was like to live as a nobleman?
Meryn's cloak blew in the wind. Lord Dalinar's cloak, given to him as a symbol of Meryn's oath of service. Arador regarded Meryn for a long, uncomfortable moment.
I won't take you even if you offer, Meryn, Ardor finally said. I can see the indecision in your eyes, and this isn't a task for the uncommitted. Take care of Renarin until I return.
With that, Ardor turned and climbed into his saddle. Within a few moments, all 15 men were gone, riding from the city and trailing the dust of their broken oaths behind them.